You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 15th, 2016. I am Michael Brooks on a Michael Wednesday. On the Majority Report, we are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, on the four-time award-winning Majority Report. Today's program, Professor Juan Cole, the proprietor of Informed Comment blog, internationally recognized scholar, on the Middle East, on Islam, on geopolitics. We're going to be talking about the terror attack in Orlando, the anti-gay terrorist attack in Orlando, why we're still not talking about ISIS and terrorism and Islam in the right way, what is actually happening in Syria, what is actually happening with ISIS. He's going to break it down for us, give us a global view of the current situation. Plus, Donald Trump, not going well. He's diving in the polls. He's imploding. The Republican Party doesn't know what to do. We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk more about how even this despicable conspiracy theorizing about President Obama that Trump is engaging in, suggesting that he's secretly in on terrorism. Yeah, that also, like the rest of Trump's racism and xenophobia and robust stupidity, it's not really that far from the rest of the Republican Party. We'll connect the threads. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders had a chill sesh last night. He's still not endorsing her, but it does look like we're going in that direction. We'll talk about that as well as the future of the Democratic Party. And we got a bunch of sound. President Obama, he doesn't want to say the magic words that Donald Trump and Sam Harris are demanding he says. He explains why, and of course, we'll get to what's really driving President Obama's refusal to use those magic words, Islamic terrorism. We've got some Donald Trump sound, got some Bill O'Reilly sound. As Bob Marley would say, so much trouble in the world. On today's Majority Report. Really quick before we get to Juan Cole, I wanted to just, and I know a lot of you are already listening to Two Dope Boys. A ton of you are listening to Two Dope Boys. Some of you aren't. You're tired of hearing about it. And some of you are interested and you just haven't had the time or crossed the threshold yet. We had a new show drop yesterday. And the reason I want to specifically point this out, we've had a bunch of great shows recently. Last week we had Malik Yoba on, who's a prominent actor who's on Empire, who's on New York Undercover, had his breakthrough role on Cool Runnings. We talked about The Creative Life. We talked about some work he's doing at a company called Iconic, Iconic 23 with his collaborator. 32. Excuse me, Iconic 32. Why did I think of 23?
Michael Jordan.
That actually is why. That's so weird. Iconic 32. But the point is we've had a lot of great conversations. We come out Tuesday and Thursday, but on yesterday's program, and on tomorrow, we have a special both crew guest, and a crew is a rotating group of amazing people that we have who are journalists, activists, strategists, creatives, who are co-host the show with us. We had a special guest crew that came out for the show yesterday, and that was my sister, Leisha Brooks. She killed it, and I'm really excited about it. So I just kind of wanted to let people know. And I also just wanted to share this one iTunes review. We're at 113 iTunes reviews now, but this one review, I think, really kind of caught what we're striving to do, and this person, fortunately, thinks we're succeeding. So I just wanted Matt to do just this shameless plug, read that review of Two Dope Boys, which you should subscribe to on iTunes today. It's also available on Stitcher. Two Dope Boys and a Podcast.
All right, it's headlined, Keeping It Fun, Keeping It Critical. Any show that can range from how stupid Whole Foods is to the spread of global Afrobeat culture to climate modeling predictions in one episode has my vote. Sort of like The New Yorker in its variety, but way more left, way more fun, way ahead of the cultural curve, and way less white. Looking forward to seeing the show evolve and continue to get tighter.
It's awesome. I mean, when I read that, I felt like we're definitely at least partially doing what we're supposed to do. And what do you think? What do you think, super producer Matt Leck?
If part of what we're supposed to do is elicit fantastic reviews like that, I think mission accomplished.
I don't know if I want to bring mission accomplished into this. So, yes, please, if you haven't already, subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast on iTunes or check it out on Stitcher. It's available where all quality podcasts are available. And, you know, some people obviously tweet to me about it, tweet to Phil about it, tweet to Matt about it. And we're always curious and eager to hear your feedback. I'm really excited about what we're doing with the show. But I just had to mention it because having my sister come in studio and talk about the film work and the comedy and the TV work that she does was really exciting. And we did a deep dive on athlete activism.
Yeah, listeners brands. To this show will like the Muhammad Ali episode. And there's also some bonus. We also go into the Ken Starr video in more depth on that, too. So
yes, on our brand F-Up segment. Really proud of what we're doing. So I just want to take this opportunity to talk about that. We will be right back with Professor Juan Cole on the Majority Report. Know that the Gideon star. When all the money that they rob from ghetto youths ain't enough to fly you to Mars. When the system you defend start break down like a Lego. When the whole world becomes a ghetto, that's when you realize the whole of we are ghetto people. Ghetto people. So tell me suppose the slave don't forget the people. People, call them all. Remember Haile Selassie never left the people. No time at all, not even an inch. Oh, no. Hey, give me a phone, a demaka, a ital, no grabber. Make me call and start up and everything proper. Every U-tap shot apart the zigzagger. Make me show you what a clock a strike in a jam rack. Politician, them a chat a tongue sharp like maka. Them not no vision, them a scammer. We a wave, they but now what kind of honor? Uno na treat the youths with honor. Let me show no vibes. Not true, you're living uptown. When the banks fall down, then the whole of we a get a youth. And me poor, you rich, but when the poor shift, then the whole of we a get a youth. And me black, you white, but when famine strike, then the whole of we a get a youth. On that day, welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Professor Juan Cole. He is the founder, the publisher, and the proprietor of Informed Comment blog, which is cannot be said enough. It's an absolutely indispensable resource for understanding what's happening in the Middle East. He's also a professor at the University of Michigan. Professor Cole, how are you?
Just fine, thanks.
It's really good to be speaking with you. So we had this attack last weekend in Orlando. That as the more sort of information that's revealed about it, it seems very clear that, and I'm also first kind of want to set up a continuum and get your perspective on this, because this is a sort of framework of how I've sort of viewed these attacks, and I think how some people are trying to sort of disaggregate. So say you have one category of people who maybe, as an example, they're operational member of Nusra or ISIS. They're operating in Syria. Maybe they're people like the September 11th attackers. And you could say a category of people who are actually fully paid up operational members of global, you know, terrorist organizations. And that's one very clear category. And then we have this sort of gray zone of maybe like the attacks in San Bernardino, where we could say, okay, there's a clear ideological commitment and affinity here, but logistically and practically, this is a mass shooting. It's a mass shooting inspired by this ideology, but not operationally connected. Now it seems like we have this case of an incredibly troubled, destructive, abusive person who, you know, the ideology is like an addendum or an add-on, and he doesn't even really know what that ideology is. Yet in the public discourse, people who want to inflate and conflate these things want us to speak about these three different areas as if there is no distinction and no difference. So I wanted to, first of all, run that framework by you, see whether or not you buy it, and then get us into a broader conversation of the mistakes of how we're talking about Mateen and this specific attack.
Yeah, well, I think that you put it very judiciously. And I guess what I would add is that I'd start by looking at people who commit these horrific crimes from the point of view of what their goal is. I've mentioned that the 1992 federal code defines terrorism. And that definition is very interested in what the terrorist is attempting to accomplish, and sets out that terrorism is a group that commits violence against civilians in order to accomplish a political goal to change government policy or law. And if we started with the motivation, and clearly the federal code of that era envisaged the motivation as being political. Then sweeping up all these things that you were talking about together makes even less sense, because I, for the life of me, couldn't tell you what was the objective of shooting up that club. And I think actually I would even extend this to the San Bernardino massacre, which was an attack on a lunch cafeteria in a federal facility for challenged children. What political goal is accomplished there? I mean, if a terrorist group attacked infrastructure, tried to knock out electricity, tried to knock out a subway, in order to facilitate a more military-style attack, or if a terrorist group like the people who shoot up Planned Parenthood clearly are trying to change the law that allows abortion. Those are political goals. That's terrorism with a politics. But these guys seem to me more like that disturbed young man who shot up the theater in Aurora, Colorado, thinking that he was a Batman villain. And I think they're using ISIL the way he used Bob O'Kane's Batman characters.
I think certainly in the case of what happened in Orlando, that's true. The question that I would have for you, and tell me whether or not you think this is helpful, but it seems to me that partially what's tricky, and this is, we're going into the realm now more of, maybe even set aside San Bernardino as well to some extent, but the, you know, activities of groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which, of course, they're political, there's territorial goals, there are things that they've demanded politically. But it does seem to me that, you know, historically and contemporarily, we could still make distinctions between these groups. So groups like, whether it's historically the IRA engaged in attacks that killed, civilians and kneecapped people that they thought were collaborators. I mean, brutal stuff. Hamas engages in terrorism and brutal activities. The FARC does. So that's not particular. But clearly in all of these cases, there is very clear political objectives aligned with what they're doing. It does seem that with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and more of that continuum, there's a fusion of politics with metaphysics that maybe poses a bit of a different challenge, or do you think that's wrongheaded?
Well, no, I mean, I don't deny at all that there's a metaphysical dimension to those groups. I'm just wondering whether there is to someone who invokes the groups in this vague sort of way that this young man did in Orlando. The other thing, though, to say is that, I mean, these are the Al-Qaeda and ISIL and so forth. I mean, we shouldn't imagine that they're necessarily very pious people.
Sure.
The ISIL's command structure seems to be populated very largely by former officers of Saddam Hussein's military who, you know, were hardline socialist secularists all their lives in the Soviet model. And that they all have come around to fundamentalist religion strikes me as a little unlikely. I think it's probably there's a lot of instrumentalism there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is distinctive about Al-Qaeda and its offshoots is that one of their political goals is to polarize Muslims and non-Muslims. And so they will attack soft targets just to make Christians or Hindus hate Muslims, because they think that if the majority population then goes and mistreats Muslims and beats up on them and excludes them, that that will drive the Muslims into their arms. That is to say, they're using soft target terrorism in order to mobilize people into their cause.
Right.
And that's a little bit complicated, but as I have pointed out, in the early 20th century, there were radical political groups, and sometimes Leninists, who engaged in the same sort of revolutionary logic and who called it, you know, a sharpening of contradictions.
Right.
So it's not unprecedented.
No, not at all. So then let's then the natural extension of that conversation is obviously, Donald Trump. He's the extreme example of someone who is playing, you know, exactly the role that ISIL wants him to play. I think that there's a number of people. I think even to some degree, I would never draw a direct equivalency, but I think that unfortunately, you know, Hillary Clinton, I don't think is as steadfast in President Obama is in not indulging in certain sort of rhetorical nonsense. So let's get to that. We have Donald Trump. President Obama called him out for both the sort of un-American aspect of using and exploiting bigotry towards Muslims to advance a political agenda, and also the, you know, actual policy proposals of banning Muslims are tremendously un-American. But he also connected it with the, just as you're saying, he recognizes the security dimension of that kind of rhetoric. It is undermining of the actual operational efforts to undermine groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. I want you to comment on that, but you also critiqued President Obama himself for drawing, far too much of an equivalency, or not an equivalency, a connection rather, between what took place in Orlando and the operational results of military engagement against ISIL in Syria. So we'll get to that more in a bit, but why don't you speak to those contradictions first?
Yes, well, Obama gave, I think, one of the more powerful speeches of his presidency yesterday. I hesitate to cavil because it was quite good, and most of the points that the president made were correct. And,
yes.
You have to admire his intelligence in facing this very difficult set of situations. But I do think that, the security people around him, Comey at the FBI and Brennan at CIA and so forth, told him that this young man was, you know, a self-radicalized terrorist in the Al-Qaeda mode. And I'm suggesting that as far as we can tell, that was just big talk on his part,
mm-hmm.
that he didn't know anything about those groups. I mean, he said that he was, he appears to have told an FBI informant that he, at one point that he was Hezbollah, and at another point that he was ISIL. Well, if you know anything about what's going on in the Middle East, you know, Hezbollah and ISIL are fighting one another. You can't decide to be one or the other.
Or he's like an unprecedented super terrorist that has never been able to build alliances like this before, in which case, terrifying. Well, maybe he's not even really dead.
And then, of course, the one is Shiite and the other is Sunni. And the only way that you could say that you were a member of both is that you didn't really have a firm idea of what Sunnis and Shiites were. And so I think this young man, you know, he's born in New York and brought up in the United States, is relatively ignorant of Middle Eastern religion and politics. And so he was just talking big. He knows that, you know, the mainstream society is afraid of these groups. And psychologists call it ego inflation.
Right.
Was what he was engaged in. So the president, I think, represented him as a far more serious person than he appears to be. I mean, my own guess, and we can't tell for sure, but just speculating that from what we have heard is that he had a very active dating life at that club, and at some point was jilted, and that's what set him off. So I think this was a much more personalistic story of struggles with being in the closet or gay
Certainly.
Identity and being an immigrant from a culture where at least formally that's frowned on, although actually, homosocial practices in Afghanistan are quite widespread. So I thought that the president's framing of this as, you know, basically a war on terror framing violated a lot of the details of what we know about this particular case.
Certainly. So that said, problematic connection aside, he did sort of open the door up to discussing our success to some degree in Syria in terms of reversing ISIL's gains. There's obviously still many other variables in that region that just the sort of exclusively military approach to ISIL are not going to address. And of course, civilians still bear the just sort of horrific brunt of this from every imaginable angle. But so I want to get to the operational reality on the ground, but the bridge that I'm going to use here is an incredibly awkward and delusional piece of sound from Bill O'Reilly, who was on Stephen Colbert. And I don't play this sound because I expect you to meditate on Bill O'Reilly's geopolitical insights. But I do think that there is something here about the connection that you're drawing that even in this sort of minimal way that Obama did, we're still seeing this played out in the popular culture here with O'Reilly in a really sort of stunningly overstated way that, could have some very real implications for both how the public actually understands what's actually happening in Syria right now, as well as, again, in some ways actually kind of aggrandizing and reifying a group like ISIL by sort of injecting it with far more power than it has in reality. So let's listen to Bill O'Reilly, and then you can take it from there. You can get remedial with Mr. O'Reilly.
We went to war in Iraq.
Mistake.
We treat it as a military.
That was a mistake.
So why is this not a mistake to treat
we
this
wouldn't
as a
be
military
an
event?
We wouldn't be an occupier here. This is a war of attrition against a terror group. That's the same philosophy as the Nazis. It's the Third Reich. It's the same. There's no. The
but how does that stop a lone gunman here in the United States?
Doesn't.
From doing
I told
this kind
you,
of thing?
You can't stop it.
You
that.
Can't stop it. So
you
why are we going?
It.
Why would we then declare war based on this?
Because then, rather than outsourcing the fight against ISIS to the Kurds,
mm-hmm.
NATO would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And NATO would then destroy command and control
mm-hmm.
of ISIS, all right, and Al-Qaeda, destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be, right now, guys like Mateen think ISIS is winning because they're on the internet and ISIS is telling them they're winning and
mm-hmm.
ISIS is causing all kinds of trouble. Once the world sees that these people are being annihilated, and I mean annihilated, mm-hmm. all right, that whole propaganda, we're winning the jihad, the caliphate, we're going to get this established, vanishes.
Professor Cole, thoughts, and then tell us what's actually happening there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mr. O'Reilly's premise that if only you destroyed the leadership of this organization in the Middle East, that it would tamp down on terrorism in the West because young men would not see it as a success story and would avoid it, is not true and can be demonstrated not to be true because bin Laden was killed and people still follow al-Qaeda. And actually, some sociologists did an experiment in the 50s with people who believed that the world was about to end and gave dates and then wanted to know what happened when the dates passed, as they always do, without the world ending, at least so far. And they found that people who had those beliefs who were disappointed in the details actually doubled down and became more committed to their organization and to their leader. And you can see this with, the Franklins and the evangelical community who often set dates for the end of the world. It doesn't work that way. People are not as rational as Mr. O'Reilly assumes that they are. But the other thing, of course, is that ISIL is not very much like the Nazis in any important dimension. The Nazis had an army of one of the great armies of the world with the Junker Prussian tradition behind it and lots of tanks and iron and airplanes and took over Europe. ISIL has from the very beginning been hyped in the Western press. I mean, it has a few dusty desert towns in places where the central government was unable to assert its authority. It was never, an important geopolitical event of the sort that people made it out to be. And it is, as the president points out, gradually being rolled back now, mainly by the efforts of regional forces.
Yeah, can you sort of elaborate upon that a bit? I mean, is it primarily the Kurds? Is it Iran? What is the sort of operational reality of how they're getting rolled back and what's filling that vacuum?
No, it's just that nobody likes them.
Yeah.
So, right. If you totaled up all of the campaigns against them, you have hardline Shiites who are allied with Iran, and then you have Kurds of various sorts, both, sort of right-wing Kurds and far left-wing anarchist Noam Chomsky-style Kurds.
Yep. And then you have... Our favorite Kurds on the Majority Report.
And then you have the various kinds of Arab rebels in Syria against the regime who also, have taken on ISIL. And in fact, al-Qaeda and ISIL split with one another, so al-Qaeda attacks ISIL. And then you have the Syrian regime itself, which still probably controls 70% of the population, is sending its army against it. And Russia has been involved, and Iran has been involved, and even, the Gulf countries, which are more afraid of Iran than they are of ISIL, have flown some sorties against ISIL and so forth. So you can't really find very much of anybody in the region who hasn't attacked them.
Right, right, right. And yet this myth that they still sort of represent some kind of enduring truth about the nature of Islam or Muslims endures in the United States and endures in Western discourse. I don't want to, again, I want to be careful about making some distinctions here. So, of course, the most extreme example is throughout Republican politics, not just Donald Trump, but, of course, very much embodied in Donald Trump, but throughout many discourses in Republican politics, but also in a number of people that sort of claim to be on the left, there is this, first of all, as President Obama said, this demand for the almost kind of magical incantation of the phrase radical Islam. And then this sort of almost its own version of the metaphysical belief that ISIS is somehow, or ISIL is somehow expressing some enduring truth, as I say, about Islam and Muslims.
Yeah, well, that trope has a long tradition in Western culture going back to the Battle of Tours and the Crusades and so forth. And, Martin Luther was very afraid of the Ottoman Empire in his day. And For some strange reason, the West is really obsessed with Islam and the possibility that it might be dangerous or powerful or whatever, and in ways that I don't entirely understand, to tell you the truth, because, you know, horrible things are happening in some parts of Africa, and we had, you know, over a decade ago, basically a world war in the Congo with 40 nations involved, in which 5 million people died. And that never, you know, came across our radar. It wasn't even reported on the evening news for the most part. But if some small thing happens in the Middle East, we get very alarmed about it. So there's something irrational about this fixation on Islam. Some people have suggested that because, you know, they're actually so like Christian Europe and, mm-hmm. And Christian Europe civilization, that there's a kind of mirror image issue here that Christian Europe then wants to be their rival. But, I mean, you know, if you look at what's been happening in the Middle East, in the Arab world, for instance, Tunisia has had two successful elections, has a new secular constitution that grants women equal rights with men. There have been improvements in the Moroccan constitution. Egypt has gone in an authoritarian direction, but one that is extremely hostile to political Islam and sees right. even the Muslim Brotherhood as a form of terrorism. This is a country of 91 million. It's like a fifth of all of the Arabs. So that, you know, a million people in the city of Mosul are living under this phony caliphate is unfortunate, and I don't think it will last very much longer. But to take that as signaling the most important thing about that's happening in the region is a little bit bizarre. You know, it's gotten to the point in Egypt where it's a little bit dangerous to wear a beard because people dislike Muslim fundamentalists so much there. And again, this is the major Arab country. You know, you could make an argument that statistically speaking, the most important thing that's happening in the region is a backlash against political Islam, so that even the pro-Muslim party, Ennahda or Renaissance in Tunisia, has announced that it's going to become more secular.
Yeah, that they're not, that in fact, that they really are explicitly saying essentially that they're, I mean, as far as I read it, that they're, you know, they're sort of Christian Democrats in the sense that, or, yeah. you know, Muslim Democrats. We have cultural affinities. We have things that we're going to pay respect to. But fundamentally, our politics are anchored in constitutional order and democracy and not in Islam. But we pay cultural respect to it. I mean, this is a very important point because you've written a book that came out fairly recently called The New Arabs, where this, in some ways, And I think this, in my mind, this is another sort of three-step process. There's one notion, again, and it's connected with these discourses on Islam, that the Middle East is a relatively fixed and stable state thing. It doesn't really change. And basically what you have is you have, you know, hordes of bloodthirsty fundamentalists, and then you have a handful of kind of families and dictatorships and militaries that can kind of keep order. And, in some ways, that's been the practical expression of U.S. foreign policy for a while, including actually supporting Gulf countries that do, for very material reasons, fund and propagate extreme Salafism and fundamentalism. But that's a, you know, that's sort of a story for another, well, not entirely a story for another day, but in some respects it is. And then there was this notion that, you know, the Arab movements and the Arab revolutions happened beginning in 2011. It was this brief shining moment, but basically it's been a failure. That's obviously not entirely true because we see the success of Tunisia. But the story of your book is that those movements, as I interpret it, were the first kind of, they were the first shockwave in a massive demographic and ideological shift that is over the next decades going to play out in a drastically reformed and different looking Middle East just because of the sort of technological and demographic realities of new generations and an incredibly youthful population across the entire region.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for mentioning The New Arabs, which I think is still a salient book to understand what's going on in the region. I think we most often talk about politics in the Middle East in a very superficial way. You were really unusual in being interested in things like the social history. But the fact is that the place is changing in social ways that matter. So it's much less rural than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
More and more people are living in cities. In some countries like Saudi Arabia or Libya, people are mostly urban. And it's much more literate than it used to be. It's much more wired than it used to be. And the youth, you know, are the pioneers in all this. They're digital natives. So, you know, if there's an election in Britain or in France, like the election in London, where one of the candidates is Muslim, that's happening real time in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And especially among the youth, they've got their eye on this. They're following it. And so, you know, that bleeds over into their politics inevitably. So I think if you keep your eye on this millennial generation and their successors, they're going to be creating quite a different kind of Middle East. And I think, you know, the old days of the family, mafias being in charge in Syria and Egypt and so forth, that's going to be really difficult to reproduce. And it was made possible in part by the fact that most people were farmers and weren't very connected with one another. You didn't have, even today, you don't have a lot of grassroots political parties. And that's all changing now in a really remarkable way. And people are also very openly wrestling with this issue of the heritage of Islam, what it means for politics, what it means for daily life, what it means for women's rights, for gay rights. And things are being said and debates are being held that just would have been impossible 50 years ago. So this idea of the place being static and, you know, sort of trapped in a kind of eternal fundamentalism is not only not true, it is the opposite of the reality. This extremely dynamic place where, you know, my expectation is that Egypt, which is now maybe 50-50 rural and urban, another 20 years, and it'll be a completely urban place. And you know, the young people who then grew up only in a city and went to school, were literate, had the internet, had the world at their feet, they're not going to look very much like, you know, the old Egyptian peasants that we used to watch on TV.
And not only that, that a lot of the challenges and crises that they face are also in some ways, you know, we're both watching each other in real time. They're dealing with issues of profound inequality, different tiered justice systems. I mean, I'm not drawing a direct equivalency, but there's a lot of parallels there. And as a kind of final question, as we move towards wrapping this conversation up, it seems to me, and again, please, you know, enlighten me on this, that while, of course, it's different and unprecedented in terms of the types of social questions that are in play, the types of conceptions of power, technology, and all the rest, that we're also just seeing in some ways that, you know, back in the, you know, 50s and 60s, and a lot of, you know, Arab nationalist leaders were not, I mean, they were, in fact, Arab nationalists. A lot of the movements that got rid of the vestiges of colonialism were not, you know, Islamic. They were secular. They were maybe socialist in orientation. They, I'm sure, you know, could be respectful to Islam, but they were not religiously driven politics. And my understanding has been that part of the rise and the backlash of this sort of right-wing Islamic politics has both been a function of Saudi money and influence and Gulf geostrategic influence, but also the failure of secular politics and now a kind of rushing in and filling the vacuum. Now we see the failure of the type of Islamic politics, and there's a new interest in secularism that is informed by all these other values that you're talking about. So in some ways, it's entirely new and unprecedented, but it's also digging back to sources within the Middle East itself, just as you say, because it's not a static situation.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, for all its faults, the current government of Egypt, headed by President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, you know, has encouraged a nostalgia for the 1960s when Gamal Abdel Nasser was the secular nationalist leader. So you're very right that these themes are coming around again now. And one of the side effects of ISIL has been, I think, to tar political Islam with this brush of extremism across the region, and people are running away from it. I think that's one of the reasons the Tunisian party, redefined itself. Fundamentalism is getting a very bad name because these guys, you know, they have a doctrine that they have developed for political purposes that they call acting like wild beasts or tawahush.
Mm.
And you cut people's heads off and you engage in mass executions. And this is deliberate on their part to scare their enemies into submission, to make it less likely people will resist them when they come into an area, to attract recruits. I mean, it is an instrumental policy of acting like wild beasts, but that policy has been tried by others in the past, and it always ends up with you committing suicide in your bunker. The young people in the region are looking at this with absolute horror, and I think it is pushing them, many of them, away from political Islam. And the problem that one has is that, you know, the people who are in charge are the baby boomers, and they're kind of my age. I'm 63, and the people who are in charge of Iraq, you know, like Haider al-Abadi, they belong to this old 1960s Dawa party, which is kind of Shiite fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know how to get out of it. They think they're happy that they came to power, but they don't understand that Shiite fundamentalists have a lot of problems, you know, being even-handed with the Sunni Arab population of Iraq, which is how they lost, you know, the west and the north of the country to ISIL. And what Iraq really needs is a secular, liberal democratic party or labor party, center left that can, you know, gather up people, Kurds and Shiites and Sunnis across the board. And in other Arab countries, these things exist, but not in Iraq. And in Syria, you really now have a choice between Al-Qaeda-type groups or this horrible one-party repressive regime of the Ba'ath Party, which by now, you know, has committed crimes against humanity. So, you know, it's like having a choice between the old East German communist government or a very hardline fundamentalism. And so people in Syria, I think, are confused and they don't know how to go forward. But people over time, you know, will construct new forms of politics that overcome the obstacles and the problems that have produced the current crisis.
And it can come and is coming from inside.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think that this the Kurdish group that's fighting ISIL in northern Syria, in which the U.S. Pentagon has decided to put its bet on, the YPG,
yep,
is politically really interesting. I mean, these are kind of socialist anarchist feminists.
Yep.
They're Sunni Muslims. I mean, they're from a Muslim background, but their political ideology really pays no lip service to Islam whatsoever. And they're making the kind of experiments that, you know, some of the youth in the United States did in the 1960s. So this is very exciting kinds of politics. It's happening in an extremely tragic way in which there's a lot of loss of life and destruction. But, you know, they would not have been allowed to express themselves under the Ba'ath Party. They are now, you know, possibly one of the saviors of Syria.
It's fascinating, and I'm glad that we were able to, as always, paint a much, much broader, richer, and fuller picture, because that's the reality. And so many times, and that frustrates me in this discourse, is that, you know, people with this sort of kind of very, very belligerently primitive view of this stuff will say that if you complicate the picture at all, you're just not being intellectually honest. And it's sort of like, you know, it's almost like somebody doing, you know, fractions in fifth grade telling an astrophysicist that they're, like, you know, not not doing the numbers right or something. It's like, just no, it's actually just far more complicated and far more interesting and potentially optimistic in the long run. So Professor Cole, I just appreciate your time as always so much, and it's informed comment. That's where we can find all of your work, and appreciate your time immensely.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, be well. Okay, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half.
He's great.
He's amazing. You sounded a little Bill Clinton there. Yeah.
He's great. No, I lost it.
Juan Cole does an amazing job. It's true. It's really, really true. Here's another reason you can't vote for my wife. Number one, if you want change in the Middle East, you need to not support a proven war criminal. Let's see. Okay. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. That's how you can call me to talk. Call us to talk. We're all here. We take your phone calls. The IMs are open. I want to say up front, I do not know. We will probably not get to all IMs because trying to tighten that up a little bit. But I'll get to as many as possible. Become a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the Majority Report code. Get the Majority Report blend. That's what you should do. Go to Majority Report Kickback, and if you're going to use Amazon, use our Amazon link. And if you want to try Jet, which is the new and improved and highly ethical Amazon, check Jet out through the Majority Report link. Go to our YouTube channel. What is the name of the YouTube channel now? Has it been renamed?
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar at YouTube channel. Subscribe there. You can watch all of our clips, including clips that I do. I do three different segments, Debunked, Global Quickie, and Everything You Need to Know in 3, which are all standalone YouTube segments that some people seem to like and enjoy. So check that out by subscribing to our YouTube channel. That's the way you can follow it. If you haven't already, I assume you probably have if you're listening to this, but if you haven't already, subscribe to us on iTunes. Write us a review on iTunes. Share some of our videos on Facebook. Start an argument with your conservative friends. Start an argument with your liberal friends. Start an argument with anybody. Just use us as a vehicle to start those arguments. And, of course, to create a more enlightened, sustainable, durable, and fun culture, subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a podcast on iTunes. We will see you in the fun half.